Now, from Secret Service misconduct to military misconduct, there have been several recent incidents. The inadvertent burning of Qurans, Marines urinating on Afghan corpses, the massacre of Afghan civilians by an army sergeant, and the release of photos of U.S. soldiers, some of them grinning, posing with dismembered insurgents. Andrew Bacevich served as an army officer in Vietnam. He's now a professor of history and international relations at Boston University. You can go to hereandnow.org to read his recent Washington Post op-ed on military misconduct. And he joins me in the studio. Professor Bacevich, welcome back to Here and Now.
Thank you very much.
Professor Bacevich, your piece in the Post was about military accountability, or maybe I should say lack of accountability, because you maintain that it's our top military leaders who should take the blame or at least share it for these sorts of incidents. Is that a fair characterization of your view?
I think it is. You know, as I reflect on the events that are unfolding in Afghanistan, I think it would be a terrible mistake to think that these sorts of episodes of grotesque misconduct happen everywhere all the time. But I think we would be naive to think that the only episodes of misconduct that have occurred are those that have come to light. So we have a problem here. And I am a little upset that the military's response to trying to correct these problems is to lean on the people at the very bottom of the chain of command. I'm not upset that the people at the bottom get leaned on. What I am upset about is that more senior officers seem never to be held accountable for these sorts of events. And if we are going to get this problem under control, we are going to have to concentrate the minds of the generals. And there are times when the best way to concentrate their minds is to fire a couple of them.
We should acknowledge that wartime atrocities have been happening for as long as there is war. But do you think there's anything different or distinctive about the soldier misconduct of recent years compared to previous wars, no matter when or where in history?
Well, you're absolutely correct that war induces barbarism. So any significant conduct that lasts for any significant period of time will, I think, inevitably include episodes of misbehavior more or less like those that we are learning about in Afghanistan. But what makes this situation different is that, setting aside moral considerations, and I don't mean to set them aside because they don't matter, but setting aside moral considerations, there have been wars where misbehavior by U.S. troops hasn't particularly affected the outcome one way or the other. That's not the case with this war. This is a war in which we will never succeed unless we can persuade the Afghan people that our purposes coincide with their purposes. I mean, the cliche used for this is win hearts and minds. We do need to win their hearts and minds. And in that regard, misconduct becomes not simply a moral problem, but it becomes a policy problem.
In your Washington Post piece, you wrote, and here I quote you, "For too long now, command accountability for our troops' misconduct in wartime has been more theoretical than real." By that, do you mean that there is a system in place to hold top brass accountable? We're just not following the system.
Well, there's a theory in place. And the theory is one that says that commanders, and it doesn't specify commanders of any particular rank in this regard, the commanders are responsible for everything that happens to occur within their jurisdiction. And indeed, there has been an effort to enforce this notion of accountability among the captains and the lieutenants and the sergeants when there's misbehavior at a lower level. But with regard to the wartime incidents that occurred both in Iraq and now more recently in Afghanistan, the generals skate. And I think that's a problem. And I think the military needs to recognize that it has a problem. And the military needs to be the ones that act vigorously in this regard.
Now, we are talking primarily about the military, but where is civilian control of these problems?
I think that's a good question. When Secretary of Defense Gates became Defense Secretary, he seemed to go out of his way to try to reverse this growing absence of accountability by senior military officers. For example, when the Air Force lost control of a couple of nuclear weapons or nuclear weapons components, he fired the chief of staff of the Air Force. He fired his four-star Air Force general. When we had that terrible episode of wounded soldiers at Walter Reed Army Hospital being essentially warehoused in totally substandard facilities, Gates fired the Surgeon General of the Army. So there we have a senior civilian, quite appropriately, I think, signaling when there are failures of performance, even by junior people, generals were being held accountable. Now, the problem is that the episodes I just referred to were episodes that happened back here in the United States of America, where there has been misconduct in war zones in Iraq and in Afghanistan. There, senior officers have not been held accountable. And my argument is that if we really wish to make a serious effort to prevent the recurrence of these sorts of episodes that we've had over the last several weeks in Afghanistan, then we're going to have to apply this Gates standard to commanders who are in the wartime theaters.
On NPR this week, the retired Army Major General Robert Scales, who's a Vietnam combat veteran and a historian, said, quote, "When soldiers get tired and they've been in the field a very long time and the stress begins to build without very tight supervision from small unit leaders, soldiers, remember these are 18 and 19-year-old kids with a camera, go out and do stupid things," end quote. And here's journalist Seymour Hersh talking about the My Lai massacre in Vietnam in 1968 when U.S. soldiers killed hundreds of Vietnamese civilians. This is from a 2008 interview on Democracy Now.
Because what happens inevitably is when you don't see an organized enemy and you lose people, you lose your buddies and your mates and you're angry, you take it out on the villagers, you take it out on the civilian population.
Now, no one is excusing this kind of conduct, but again, keeping in mind that you were a soldier in Vietnam, should civilians have sympathy for this kind of behavior?
Well, as citizens, we should have great empathy, at least, for the soldiers that we send on these wars that are virtually unwinnable and, in the eyes of some of us, also unnecessary. So, yes, in that regard, we should try to understand the circumstances in which they are obliged to serve, but there cannot ever be any excusing this kind of misconduct. And I think the My Lai comparison is both appropriate and inappropriate. It's inappropriate in the sense that the scale of the misconduct in Afghanistan simply does not compare in any way. But the comparison is appropriate in the sense that, yes, here too today, as in Vietnam, we have these long, drawn-out wars in which the stresses imposed upon the soldiers are enormous. But to make note of those tremendously difficult circumstances offers us some understanding of why these incidents occur, but cannot be used to excuse them. Indeed, an appreciation of the difficulty of the circumstances in which our soldiers are serving makes it all the more imperative to hold the senior leadership accountable.
Andrew Basevich is a professor of history and international relations at Boston University. He's also editor of the new book, The Short American Century, a Postmortem. After a short break, we'll have a report from Afghanistan on the challenges NATO troops are facing as they try to fight a war and draw down at the same time. Back in a minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Find over 200 job openings at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back. In Afghanistan, the spring fighting season is underway. Insurgent attacks have killed at least 36 NATO troops this month, including one today. The Taliban launched a series of coordinated attacks on Kabul and other cities a week ago. But this week, NATO officials said they're hopeful about making progress in the war and about the Afghan army's ability to take control of security. Military analyst Andrew Basevich of Boston University is with us. Professor, do you share that optimism?
Well, we have to understand that the optimism is expressed with regard to a definition of success that becomes ever lower as time passes along. The definition of success, I think, now, both in Washington and for NATO as a whole, is if we can get out around 2014 without having Afghanistan collapse instantly into chaos with the Taliban taking over, that we'll declare that a victory, and we better put the word victory in quotes. Yeah, I think there probably is at least a reasonable chance, by no means a sure thing, that we are going to be able to get out with our forces intact in the next couple of years. I certainly would not bet my paycheck that once U.S. and NATO forces leave that we are going to see a stable Afghanistan, certainly not a democratic Afghanistan, in the years that follow. I think that in that regard, anybody can make predictions, but they are probably equally valueless.
Andrew Bacevich is a professor of history and international relations at Boston University. He's also the editor of The Short American Century, A Postmortem. Next, we go to Afghanistan, where NATO forces are trying simultaneously to fight and end the war. The BBC's Quentin Somerville reports.
In a barren dust bowl in the eastern province of Paktika, an American base is disappearing back into the desert. It's the biggest base yet to close in Afghanistan. It won't be handed over to Afghan forces because they don't have the capacity to keep it running.
Lads, suck back up!
Yeah, we know.
Quite a big job, no?
No. Of course I'm lying.
So how long do you think it'll take you to turn all of this back to desert?
After I've seen the project, I'd probably say 3 to 3.5 weeks.
Huge armoured vehicles are being loaded onto transporters. 70,000 odd vehicles will be shipped back to the States. The Afghans will be left with simpler, cheaper transport. Many Afghan soldiers are now literate, though only to primary school reading level. And a school child can't read a mechanical engineering manual, so little equipment will be left behind.
The soldiers that are normally at this base have had to stop patrolling. Some officers are saying that this exercise in removing bases is a distraction. Others go even further and say that you can't wage a war and wind it up at the same time, and that the mission here in Afghanistan is now at odds with itself.
The Taliban attack on Kabul was a reminder that far from being defeated, the insurgents may be becoming more sophisticated. NATO didn't see this one coming. The war here started with a promise to make Afghanistan a better, safer place. But as it enters its 11th year, hope and ambition are on the wane. NATO's senior civilian representative is Sir Simon Gass.
I don't think it will ever be possible, as we've seen in other cities around the world, to ensure that Kabul is entirely safe. And that's why I say that we've seen attacks of this sort before, unfortunately, in Kabul, and I expect that we will see similar attacks in future.
Death to Britain, death to America, chant Afghan protesters. Relations between NATO and the Afghan government are in the doldrums, suffering from setback after setback, including the burning of copies of the Quran by US soldiers and the murder of Afghan civilians by a staff sergeant. Each event, another crack in the partnership. Veteran commanders and diplomats say things have never been this bad before. Western capitals have lost faith in President Karzai. Further east in Paktika, the men of 228 Company are heading out on patrol. The fight in Afghanistan is moving from the south of the country to the east.
We're just walking through some dry riverbeds. It's middle of the afternoon, it's quite hot, and these soldiers really are at the sharp end of the fight against the insurgents here in Afghanistan. They don't do work providing much security for the locals, and they certainly don't do the digging of wells and the building of bridges that you see elsewhere in Afghanistan. This is simply about fighting the Taliban and stopping them getting in here from across the border in Pakistan, which is just over the next line of hills. That fight, though, has got a lot harder, because already this company and companies across this province and across Afghanistan are seeing their numbers reduced.
A third of American forces, some 30,000, will have gone by September, followed by 500 British soldiers by the end of the year. Afghans will take their place, but privately, US soldiers think their partners are unlikely to hold this area. They complain that the command between the Afghan police, army and intelligence service is fractured.
Give me a grid for that location.
These soldiers take pride in being focused on the fight in front of them, but they feel that America has turned its back on this war, according to Lieutenant Archangel Moscato.
It's kind of funny, because when I go back and the people I hang out with, you know, 18 to 24-year-olds, they don't really ask me about the war because they don't really know. They might be even shocked that there's still a war going on. So there is kind of a disconnect back in the States.
Even as combat outpost Kushmund is being pulled down, the Taliban attack, US forces respond. NATO's plans for success in Afghanistan are based on hopes that will likely never become true. That by the end of 2014, the Afghan government will be competent and credible, the army ready, and that a weakened Taliban will want to talk peace. This war is about to enter its toughest phase yet. Foreign troops must battle the Taliban, reduce their own numbers and train Afghans. But the insurgents have to do one thing only, and that is to fight.
Fire! Level up the bubbles! Next round! Cross.
That report from the BBC's Quentin Somerville in Afghanistan. Next week on Here and Now, Trayvon Martin was murdered in a gated community, and one writer says the insular mentality of those places may have been a factor. Also, how our resident chef gets kids to eat healthy foods. News just ahead, Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. The Harvard Art Museums, from Chinese jades to Jasper Johns, Byzantium to Bernini. Learn more at harvardartmuseums.org. And by the Institute of Contemporary Art Boston, with Figuring Color, exploring the expressive power of color in paintings and sculpture, ICABoston.org.